Hello, my name is David Lankus. I'm a professor at Syracuse University's School of Information Studies. I also work with libraries throughout the world talking about how we can build collaboration. So I hope the organizers of the conference don't mind. I sort of stole the title of the conference because I think it's great, because I think ultimately the success of libraries today and into the future is through collaboration, in making our buildings much less vaults of knowledge and much more hubs of activity throughout a community. So I want to talk a little bit today about what that means. So let me just give you sort of a little agenda of where we're going with this. First, I want to talk about worldviews. I want to talk about the fact that when we approach the world, when we approach a problem, when we approach an agenda, when we approach a task, we bring with us a lot of preconceived notions about how things work. And I'm going to show you that the worldview that we bring, and particularly a rather increasingly old-fashioned worldview that we need to discard, can get in the way of collaboration. So I'm going to talk about why worldview matters in terms of collaboration, and I'm going to talk about two specific worldviews, a collection-centric worldview that sees the library primarily by what it owns and leases, and a community-centric worldview that sees the library primarily as part of the community. And then finally, I want to come back and talk about what the true role of you as the librarian is in that collaboration. But let's start with worldview. So there's a fellow by the name of Kuhn who wrote a fascinating book talking about the progress of scientific innovation. And there was this sort of view that scientific innovation happened in this lockstep, one discovery followed by the next discovery followed by the next discovery equals truth. And what he found is, as he went back and was sort of teaching the history of science, is that's not how it worked. He started with Archimedes, one of the famous sort of first engineers, and looked at the Archimedes screw, and he looked at how Archimedes thought of motion. And he said by today's modern physics standards, it was completely non-rational, because he sort of thought of motion, not just the motion of physical motion, but emotions and ideas in motion and things in motion. And when you look at Galileo, his astronomy compared to today's astronomy seems rudimentary. And yet, each one of these steps totally changed the worldview that preceded them and allowed for another worldview to come in. In essence, the way science progressed was not by a series of truths being discovered, but by a series of worldviews making discoveries and a series of new worldviews coming in and replacing the old worldview to make more information fit, to make more logic out of it. So the example of worldview here is the flat earth theory, right? Now, if you start with a worldview that the world is flat, that if you just take that as given, you can actually do some interesting science. Some questions sort of make sense, like, where's the edge? What happens if I fall over the edge? What's below? What's above? What's keeping this water here, etc.? And you can ask all these sorts of questions, and what's going to happen is you're not going to start asking questions like, well, but what if it's round? It doesn't fit the worldview. So what happens is eventually you're going to find data that doesn't make sense, and you're going to find enough data that eventually doesn't fit anywhere, that someone's going to have to come in, normally a newcomer from an outside worldview, saying, wait, let's not assume it's flat. Let's assume it's round. What happens then? Now, I bring this up as an example because it's sort of an obvious worldview, but I also bring it up because it turns out that it's a worldview, it illustrates a worldview that we're dealing with today. Many people, many students in second, third grade learn about Columbus, right? So Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, etc. And what they hear is the reason that Columbus wanted to go on this great expedition, the great discovery that Columbus found out, was that the world was not flat, right? This is what Columbus's major contribution to the world of navigation and industry was. Except that the misconception that people at the time of Columbus believed in a flat earth was listed by the Historical Society of Britain as the second most common error in history. In essence, we're still teaching it to second and third graders. We may still believe it in our minds. We may have been taught it ourselves. And yet the people at the time of Columbus, the king and queen in Spain and France and Italy, all were sitting with globes in front of them. In fact, they got it pretty right, except it wasn't quite big enough. They sort of missed this whole continent in the middle. So the idea that Columbus discovered that the world was round is something that we may still take as a preconceived notion, but it's been wrong since we started making songs about this. So worldviews are these inbuilt assumptions we have, these tales that we tell ourselves that make sense of the world, and they can be challenged. But oftentimes they are so strongly rooted in us that they don't get challenged, and they prevent what we can do. So how does this fit into the notion of collaboration? Well, I would argue that in library land, we still have, and I'm hoping it's increasingly a minority view, but it's still a big view of a collection-centric worldview of libraries. That is, that the library is a collection. The collection is the library. Without a collection, you don't have a library. And what is that collection? What is the nature of the collection that defines the library? It's that which is owned or leased by the library. In other words, it's the books we put on the shelves, the materials that are donated that we put in our vaults or our rare books room, or it's the databases that we provide access to in our subscription services. That's the library. And that what sits around the library, from reference to cafes to instructional services, all are meant to augment the nature of the library. That's why, for example, bibliographic instruction makes so absolute sense as a major core of what a library does. We teach people how to use the collection. Why? Because that's what we are. Today, we look at instruction within libraries as much broader than simply how do I find this Dewey number or Library Congress number. We think about information literacy. We think about privacy rights. We think of teaching people about an information world well beyond our own collection. But that's moving beyond a collection-centric worldview, and we'll come back to that in a second. What is the value of the library? The value is in connecting the community to ideas. That's true. But the primary goal is external ideas. In other words, we buy books, materials, databases, things that aren't us. And we bring them in so that you can discover what the world is around us. Think about the different promotional campaigns that public libraries put on about come to the library and discover a world beyond yourself. Discover new worlds, go beyond what's around you. This is all around the idea that what a library does best is transports people from where they are, their community, outside. Now, there's value to going outside. There is great value to going outside. But there is a huge value for integrating what you learn there back into what you do at home and what's happening at home. Once again, we'll come back to that in a second. And the mission of a collection-centric library is to provide access to information. Access is what they do. Now, what this means is when you start talking about collaboration, this worldview begins to define what it is you can collaborate on. What is a library? It's a collection. How do you collaborate? You collaborate with its collection somehow. Right? So what does that look like? Well, here's our library, which is a collection. We can work with authors. That makes sense. They help build our collection. They're in our collection. We can have speaker series and signings, and we can have people come and talk and lead book groups, and we can put together different interest groups around different authors and all this wonderful stuff. One of the most natural collaborations we have are with publishers, the people who, because authors, though increasingly so, still aren't in the majority, and particularly not people with sort of the brand name authors, producing their own things, they're going through publishers. And we see the dangers, if you will, in potential collaborations here, because publishers, we've always looked at them as a partner, and they've always looked at it as an outlet, and suddenly things are starting to change around ebooks. Suddenly our collaboration is not as friendly as we thought it was. Libraries. We collaborate with libraries all the time. You're in the middle of a meeting around a library collaboration, right? How do we do it? We share collections. We build union catalogs. We do joint collection development. We share materials in our special collections, and we share things of that nature. And museums, they got stuff, so we collaborate with museums. We can put books around. They're going to do a new exhibit on Van Gogh. They'll have the Van Gogh book materials around us. But it's a limited view. What it's limited to is what our stuff gets us. Who wants our stuff? Where can we put our stuff? And we really end about 10 feet before we need to, which is an impact. We put our stuff there, but what we care about is, do people read? Do people learn? Do people who go to that Van Gogh exhibit understand and appreciate Van Gogh in a different way? Are they inspired to paint? Are they inspired to collect? Are they inspired to think about mental health differently? That's what we care about, and our collections can't get us there. Our collections can only get this sort of seed in the ground, and what we're interested in is the flower that blooms, the knowledge, the ideas, the improvement within the community. So we need to move away from a collection-centric worldview to a different worldview. And that's where there's a lot of confusion now in library land. Where do we move? We spent so much time worrying about how do we collect something, how do we organize it, how do we sub-organize it, how do we shelve it, how do we put it in deep storage, how do we lease it, how do we license it, how do we put metadata around it. We spent so much of our profession around a collection that when you say we need to move around it, we go, where? And the answer is back where we started. Back to the reason that we've been collecting and organizing and metadataing, mark recording and organizing to begin with, which is we did that to improve the communities that we serve. Now we look at a community-centric worldview, where the library is defined by librarians and the communities that those librarians serve. It is a librarian that creates a library, not the other way around. A room full of books is a closet. An empty room with a librarian in it is a library. That's the view that people create institutions, create activities, create systems, create value. People do that, not buildings, not shelves. But it's not the librarian alone. This is what's unique to the field of public service, what's unique to the field of service in general, and unique to librarians, which is librarians cannot by themselves drive a community. They do it in concert. And this isn't simply saying we have a board or we have a set of advisors. This is literally bringing the community into decision-making, not just on challenge materials. Here's a community member who has a manga collection. There's your shelving. Here's a community member who wants to lecture on the Civil War. Here's a place to do it. Where they drive what we do, not simply respond and say, well, that was good. Where collections are tools, just like our space, just like our buildings, just like the computers, just like the Xerox machines. These are simply tools to allow us to do our job. And those tools will change from microfiche readers and DVD towers and CD towers to flat screens and 3D printers. Those tools change. But the core of the profession does not, because we are still about service and we are still about learning and community empowerment. The library becomes a community platform, and I'm going to return to that in a second. The library, what librarians create, is a platform full of resources and tools, full of possibilities and capabilities and expertise to allow the community to discover and learn and improve itself. The value in the library is in connecting the community to ideas, just as in the other worldview, but the focus is on community ideas. It's about going beyond the community, finding brilliance, and anchoring that brilliance back within your university, your school, your city, your business, to improve that place. And the mission of a librarian is to facilitate knowledge creation. That's the flower we wanted to get to. It's not simply, here's a book, I hope you learn. What do I need to help you learn? Is it a book? Is it just someone to talk to? Is it connecting you to someone else? That's what we do by facilitation. Now let me return to this idea of library as a community platform. What do I mean by that? And I'm going to do that rather than through fancy graphics. I'm going to give you some examples. In the city of Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Free Library wanted to create these sort of community centers, and I was part of organizing them. And one thing they wanted to do was create a music center. So we started talking to the musicians and music community of central Philadelphia primarily. It was about the downtown library. And what we found is, you know, we talked about, wow, we could set up, you know, exchanges where if you're a guitarist and you're looking for a drummer and all this other stuff, we could set up systems to allow you to do that, et cetera. And what we found is that, you know, the pop music, the country music, the rock music scene was pretty well handled in bars and handled in clubs, and there was already a very nice community going there that really the library wasn't going to help much with. But the world music and the classical music community were in desperate need of the library. And what they needed was a place not to find sheet music, not to check out CDs of music, but a place to perform. There weren't enough venues in downtown Philadelphia for them to perform their music, their new music. And when they saw that the library, they said, you know what we need out of the library? It's not a sheet music collection. It's not a bunch of CDs. It's not a reading room or a humming room. It's a stage with two grand pianos on it. And the library can pick what gets performed, because that selection, the ability to perform a new piece, is a badge of honor in our community. So the library can provide us with esteem, with status. And the library is welcome to capture what we've done. The business for classical music and new music composition is gone. So we're perfectly willing to share it with the world. Podcast it out. In fact, we want the library to become a publisher of the community, to publish all the music that's being composed and the analysis and thoughts. So when someone wants to know what the Philadelphia sound is, they come to the library to hear it. Not go to the library within Philadelphia to hear what everyone else is doing, but come to the library to hear what the Philadelphia sound is. And the same infrastructure you build for this classical community, for this world community, can be used to have kids send out rap music and pop music and their own podcasts and suddenly disseminate the voices of the community out. That's a platform. Where the library doesn't necessarily go and acquire new music to play, They simply provide a place for it to happen, and then they invest in a venue to distribute it, not only within Philadelphia, but the rest of the world. That's a great example that happened in Vermont. In Vermont, they used a broadband stimulus grant to connect public rural libraries across the state. And the idea was not that they were simply going to bring gigabit Ethernet to all these libraries, but then people could connect into the gigabit connections, local businesses, local homes, local organizations, and they could create a wide distribution, wide rollout of broadband throughout the state. Now, during the meeting where they were talking to librarians, sort of convincing them to come on board with this, one of the organizers was getting a little distressed because the major point of conversation was they were going to move from a free dial-up platform where they would get, you know, 56K connection for their entire library to this gigabit fiber Ethernet going into their library, and it's going to cost them like $100 a month, right, which is nothing. And so she finally got up and she goes, you have to understand that right now what you've got is a dirt path coming into your library. And what we're talking about for not a lot of money, for nothing, is we're going to bring the Autobahn straight into your library. She'll see the eyes go wide of all the librarians because all they could see were all these German cars coming at them at 150 miles an hour. And so my job was to get up and go, it's okay. No. It's not just about bringing stuff down into your community. It's also about unleashing Vermont on the rest of the world. And the example it was given in economic development was that there was an older gentleman, a gentleman reaching the end of his life, who loved snowmobiles. Loved them. Now, sort of obsessed that he would buy them. He'd buy snowmobile parts. He'd buy broken snowmobiles. He ended up with a barn full of old snowmobiles and snowmobile parts and things just sort of scattered around. Now, I have about a ton of computer equipment the same way. So, you know, this is not a judgmental statement. His grandson comes home from college and with his permission takes his laptop and a camera out to the barn, photographs all the different parts and pieces and broken down materials, inventories it, and within 2 days releases a portal where anyone in the world can buy old snowmobile parts and instantaneously turns his grandfather's barn into a worldwide snowmobile distribution plant, which you might think, really? And the answer is, over in Siberia, quite literally Siberia, they have broken down snowmobiles they can't find parts for anymore. Suddenly they're purchasing from rural Vermont. Now the library provided the bandwidth to allow that to happen, provided some of the education in how they connect to the bandwidth or use the bandwidth, some advice in sort of the technology side of this, but the library made it happen. Nopal, North Onondaga Public Library, had people coming and talking about, I really want to know more about gardening. And rather than simply handing them more books about this is how to garden, because many of them were in apartments or didn't have a place to garden, Meg Bacchus, who's now at Chattanooga Public Library, said, why don't we garden? And so for the cost of her time, granted, and a hose, they built plots next to the library, they had plenty of room, where people would garden. And the community could, you could loan out a spot or you could share a spot. And at the end of the season, when they ended up with way too many tomatoes, as we always do, they suddenly started having conversations about local food sourcing and food pantry and hunger and all these things that simply reading a book on how to make a great tomato wouldn't have led them to. It created a community, and the platform the library provided was water and land. Which is not unlike what happened in Eureka, Illinois, which is in rural southern Illinois, where a chef who just moved into the area, Chef Katie, professionally trained chef, came in and said, there's not enough places to eat lunch in this city. I'm a professional chef. I could help. And rather than the librarians handing her a business plan or local codes, they said, that corner of the library is yours on Tuesday. And she came in on Tuesday and set up a tent, set up tables, set up her food, and suddenly Tuesday became Tuesdays and Thursdays and Wednesdays and Thursdays and Fridays, and suddenly she started with a catering business. And they won an award from the Rural Economic Development Association for starting new businesses. Libraries can start new businesses. Libraries in universities can become integral parts of entrepreneurship training and startups and tech startups and create startups within businesses. They can become the place of innovation. That's what libraries a portal is. Polaris, which is an integrated library system, built a new system called a community portal. And the idea was that within the Syracuse area, and they rolled it out wider, the librarians wanted to say, you know, people are coming looking at blood donation, organ donation, whatever, and not only do I want books and materials, but I'd love to say, here are local organizations and refer them. And we have all these databases. Could we put it in with the integrated library system? And so Polaris built a system so they could sort of input this brain box into the catalog. It could show up as results. And as librarians were entering this data, they realized they weren't the best ones to be entering the data. They didn't necessarily have the most up-to-date information. They weren't the most compelled to keep it up-to-date. That, in fact, the local organizations, if they could provide a login, they could keep it up-to-date. Local nonprofits, they found that county agencies had all these services to provide, but no one knew they existed. Suddenly, county agencies could enter their data in, and as people were searching for unemployment or youth services or parenting advice, not only would they find books and materials, but real services they could take advantage of. And so this information was being input not by librarians, but by the community itself. And there's discussions in some communities about letting for-profit organizations, Joe's Pizzeria, or a consultant, or a tutor come in and add their information, and the library can create their own web page for them. Then, what's very interesting is a doctoral student at Syracuse University decided that he had a great idea. The university and the city had created what they called the connective corridor, a bus route that connected the university on the hill to downtown. And what he wanted was that someone could get up and through an iPad say, I'm coming up to this stop, what's going on here? And what he found was all this data sitting at the library about community events and community places. And so he built an iPad app that people could say, what's coming up to the stop? And say, well, there's a blood drive here, there's this organization, there's this agency, this branch library, whatever it is. Now think about that for a minute. The app was not built by the library. The information the app was consuming was not provided by the library. But that was impossible without the library. The library was the platform that allowed a community to innovate, to develop new tools, to develop new ways of informing itself, of developing new ways to be a community, and the library was essential in it, but it didn't have to control it from end to end. It didn't have to make it part of its collection. So when we talk now about the idea of the library as a platform, we talk about collaboration, a whole new host of collaboration is possible now. But here's the thing. The library isn't going to do the collaboration. The collection isn't going to do the collaboration. The most fundamental, important instrument, tool, device of the library to collaborate is you, the librarian. It takes people to make this happen. It takes people to go out into the community, to leave your buildings, to sit with local business leaders, to sit with local community leaders, to sit with people suffering, to sit with communities and the county and faculties and departments and principals and say, what's going on? What do you need? And the answer may not be, oh, I've got it. I hear this is what the library can do for you. It may be, you know what? Joe over there, he's dealing with it too. And you're connecting people together. And that requires people, and people to people, and people connection. And that's why the librarian is what makes the library, and that's why the human touch is the most vital thing the library has in its future. It's not that we can build bigger, better, badder collections than Google and Amazon and all these other things. It's that we are the community. Be that community an academy, be that community a school, be that community a business, be that community a locality, a state. We can be our part of it. We bring something not simply local because we're present, but local because we talk, converse, and understand the community. Now, how do we do that? What are the means of collaboration? What are the means by which librarians facilitate these collaborations? Well, first is access. But not just access to resources, not simply access to the stuff we got behind us, but access to people and ideas and tools. We buy tools just like there are books that no one individual could afford. There are tools from Xerox machines to 3D printers. We used to do it with microfiche readers. That's still there. But it's also a matter of people and saying, have you talked to this person? Have they thought about this? Preserving privacy, being concerned and aware of those things, but ultimately understanding that privacy is a continuum where people can make informed choices if we prepare them to, which is the next way in which we facilitate these collaborations, by providing training. In a collection-centric view, that was bibliographic instruction. What's MARC? What's a call number? How do we find this stuff? We were teaching them about how to access us, how to use us. Because they certainly couldn't contribute to us, they could just use us. Let me be real clear about this. Libraries, and I don't care what library type you are, you do not have users. You do not have customers. You do not have consumers. You have members. You serve people. You serve people who consume and produce, who dream and think and disagree and agree and have opinions and have thoughts and want to connect. not simply people who come in, grab, and leave. Sure, there'll be those people, but have we ever given them the choice to do something else? Have we ever provided the invitation to say, use this library to contribute back to the community? Or do we put the bestsellers up front and the self-checkout next to it? Do we ever challenge the community to be more? We need to provide an environment that is safe, that is civil, that is physically safe, that is intellectually safe, that it talks about things like copyright and talks about things like privacy. But it also needs to be an environment that is inspiring. And that can be physically inspiring through spires of glass and beautiful collections of ancient texts, but inspiring in seeing collaboration and new thoughts. How many plaques do you have up of local authors? How many plaques do you have up of people who dreamed big and did something else? How much do you celebrate the community's victories? And lastly, motivation to collaborate. Why do people need to collaborate? Why do they need to expect being more than simply a user or a customer or a consumer? And this is where you are going to have your toughest challenge. A community is some group of people, not users, not customers, not consumers, but people seeking to improve their lives and joined by at least one common and known variable. Where they live, where they go to school, where they work, what they're working on, what they love to do. It is a complex mix of opinions and competing visions, but it's participatory. Librarians need to be a part of that complex interaction, not just informing, but pulling and pushing the community. A librarian needs to see the patterns and regularities of communities like the shape of a collection or the pattern of circulation, for it is in the complex menagerie of people that is the true collection of the library. Those people, that institution, that organization, that student, that teacher, that businessman, that homeless person, that priest, that mother, that father, that child, they are your collection. Just as much as the books and tools and materials are tools to help them, but they are your collection and they are your primary responsibility. They are your outcome. And they deserve more than someone who simply waits to help. No one ever changed the world by standing ready to serve. To be a librarian today, to truly serve the community, to truly live up to your potential, you must be a radical, positive change agent. If you want a future for libraries, it is within you, the librarians. If you want a healthy community that seeks out knowledge and seeks out informed conversation, then advocate for it beyond your walls. If you want your community to thrive, if you want your library to thrive, your community must thrive. To be a librarian is not to be neutral or passive or waiting for a question. It is to be a radical positive change agent within your community, striving for better, striving to overcome ignorance, striving to create a civil discourse, striving to make every community feel it could be better, and helping make it better, helping it through our tools of collections, sure, but also our tools of facilitation. You are the instrument. You are the wedge that will move this community up. And you're going to do it hand in hand with teachers and policemen and businessmen and parents. You're going to do it hand in hand. You can't do it alone, but you're going to be there at the front line defining what a better tomorrow is. Thank you for your time.